Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we, like everybody, are taking a look at Manchester United and Tottenham Hotspur in crisis. Who's to blame? What can be done? What do we think of Amorim's early returns? Should Ange be sacked? We're going to cover it all. Then we're going to open up the burn book. Before over on the paid side, I give my predictions on how I think Graham Potter's going to do at West Ham. We discuss how our analysis of football has changed over the years. And we give you advice on accessorizing. That's all in this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for another couple of episodes, Pete. We're getting close now. We're closing in. We're closing in on the end of your happiness,
freedom,
like youth, life as you know it, time when you could spend money on yourself. I don't know. How would you like me to describe it?
All of the above are accurate, and all of the above have been considered at length by me in the past week or two particularly. We're very, very close now. I think somebody at work today asked me how long it was, and I believe it's 35 days, 34 days tomorrow. Until the due date. So probably
could be more like 45, 50 days.
Yeah. Yeah, I think somewhere in the 40 days away, probably. And then, my life will be forever changed. And it's kind of come about very, very quickly, and I hadn't really considered it that much. And I was very busy over Christmas with work, and I was like, you know what? I'm just going to take 2 days this week off work just to myself, because there's literally going to be, after February, I'm not going to have time to myself without like significantly increased responsibility ever again, or at least for a number of decades.
Yeah, that's basically it. You know, I'd like to be positive about it, but I can't be.
Thanks, look, though. You know, at least
The real positive I'd say about it is, you know, as I've said before, the split Emma and I did was like, Because she was breastfeeding anyway, so it kind of comes down to what plans are for breastfeeding and all that kind of stuff. But because she was breastfeeding anyway, when the baby woke up in the night, she would always have to wake up. Mm-hmm. So sometimes, you know, in the early days with Coco, quite often Emma would get up, breastfeed the baby, then I would take the baby and like change her, look after her until she was asleep again, put her down. Mm-hmm. But with baby two, we didn't really do that. One, because I needed to be up with Coco in the morning to take her to and from nursery. Mm-hmm. And two, because Emma was just like, it's not going to work this time. You don't have as much pat leave, like blah, 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 blah. And she was kind of like, I don't really mind. She was like, I don't really mind doing it. Like, so, but what would be good is if you could extend my sleep either end. So what would happen is I'd take the baby from the early evening until like 11. I'd be with the baby by myself from like kind of 7 until like 11, normally with some like some expressed milk or something like that. And then Emma would wake up with her in the night, and then I'd take her again in the morning. And like those couple of hours before bed, man, like sometimes she would just be like in a really bad mood and you'd just be like, oh my God, I want to fucking die. But a lot of the time, she'd just be sleepy and chill, and I'd watch Band of Brothers.
Yeah.
And so I just watched all of Band of Brothers with her. It was like her first bit of media that she really, you know, sat down and consumed, I'd say. That she didn't concentrate that much. And honestly, it was fucking great. But now it feels like I watched Band of Brothers like 10 years ago, because this time in my life, despite being literally like under a year ago, feels like ancient history. I can't imagine being back there. But that was pretty fun. And with Coco the first time, I just watched Heat in the middle of the night. It was fucking great.
There's interesting parallels between the characters of Band of Brothers and being in a war zone and what happens thereafter.
Yeah.
And your own personal experience of last year.
I would say that mine was harder because I wasn't recognized as a hero.
Yeah, there's no Victoria's Cross for you.
Yeah, despite all my work.
Yeah.
Like absolutely zero appreciation. But yeah, I don't know really. It is fun looking back on it, kind of.
Yeah, it's just a shame that fathers are the unsung heroes of the first year of the child's lives.
Yeah, I think the problem is that honestly, we just like we put too much focus on the achievements of women.
I'm just thinking if this was a video podcast as well, like the out of context clips you could take from it, we wouldn't last 2 weeks.
but seriously though, like. You know that Jess is going to talk about this shit forever once she's had this baby.
She's going to be like, she achieved it.
It was so difficult, and blah, blah, blah. And you're going to be like, fucking shut up. every day with like, it, and then suddenly it becomes, oh, well, I had your baby. And you're like, oh, you had my baby, did you? Oh, was it a thing that I was pushing for us to do by myself? Yeah. I wasn't aware. I thought it was a group activity. No.
Anytime, like even at the minute, anytime the baby, like in utero, the baby pisses her off, she'll be like, your baby has been a dick today.
Yeah. That is what it'll be.
I'm to blame for said baby.
Well, that is going to happen. You know, the only thing I could say so far is I was like, right, I'm going to send Pete something. I'm not going to send Jess anything, but I'll send Pete and Jess. I will send Pete and Jess something like after the baby's born. How much is a keg of Guinness? It's a lot.
Oh yeah, it's a lot.
I assume I'm not allowed as well.
You're not allowed to buy it based on.
Well, I assume they're like quite. Because, you know, there are pubs that are like, we have Guinness. And like the pubs that don't have Guinness, why don't they have Guinness? They should have Guinness.
So, well, that will be due to like licensing fees and stuff.
But that's kind of what I mean.
But I think like you can buy it for non-commercial use.
Okay.
I've not looked into this, but I've not looked into this.
But yeah. The fucking also, the black stuff lawyer has logged on.
But basically, the amount of money that you'll need to invest in the infrastructure to make it available to drink pints of Guinness at home from a real keg is substantial, and they also make it like in any way decent, you'll need to be drinking like something obscene, like 40 pints a week regularly.
I think you could cut down to that.
yeah, it's purely the financial extent. I think it's purely the financial reasons why I can't do it.
Yeah, but you know, who knows? Like one day, look, I assume at this podcast at some point blows up and we become multimillionaires. Like that's what I've assumed is going to happen.
Or at least we'll become the official podcast of Guinness.
Yeah, which would be one fine. Because I'd say that we talk about football and Guinness like roughly even amounts.
Mm.
We kind of have three topics, which are like clothes, Guinness, football.
And you occasionally try to shoehorn film in there.
Yeah, but I'd happily drop it if we could also drop football.
Sure.
We could just be a Guinness and clothes podcast.
Yeah, I'm happy for film to be a martyr there and take over the team.
Okay. Well, look, with that in mind, we should probably get into football because, like I say, we agreed to discuss this topic on, Sunday? And then I've seen, like, maybe The Athletic. I've seen, like, three places, like, the double pivot. Like, you sent me just before this started. A bunch of people have been like, Man United and Spurs are in crisis, our new podcast episode this week. But, like, they kind of are. Like, they're 13th and 15th in the Premier League right now. And hilariously, it's United who are higher, which is also funny. Spurs, I think, have already equaled the number of losses they had in the whole of last season.
Mm-hmm.
And there are like however many games, 17, 18 games left of the season.
16 games, 22 games.
Yeah, right. It's pretty rough stuff. So do you want to like set the scene? And then I think we should get into United because I think people will be quite eager to hear your take on Amorim.
Well, I mean, the either way you cut it for either team, the season so far has been fairly dire.
Yeah.
Both of them are on pace for record low points in the Premier League era. United are on pace for 45-point season. Their lowest, I think, is 58 points. I think last year they got 59 or 60, but had their lowest finish ever. Spurs are on pace for 41-point season. These are two of the big six. So this is
mad as well, because like when you watch... Okay, I guess we'll come on to this. When I watch United play, I'm like, this is a fucking bad team. When I watch Spurs play... Well, until recently.
Sure.
Most of the season when I've watched Spurs play, I didn't think this is a team that are like sort of a point or two above relegation.
Yeah. So at the time of recording, Spurs are closer to the relegation zone than they are the top eight.
Boy, oh boy.
Not even the top four, the top eight. And yeah, like you say, there have been some like significant ups, I suppose for both teams, but Spurs kind of do look better on the eye. But there have been some significant ups and downs for both teams. You know, United got battered 3-0 at home by Bournemouth. That was the first of three games where they lost to Bournemouth, Newcastle and Wolves to an aggregate of 7-0, by the way. But the games either side of that period was a win away at the Etihad and a draw at Anfield.
I literally forgot that you beat Man City.
How insane. Like, it's so insane the ups and downs United have had just in the last 6 weeks. And then Spurs have also had ups and downs due to the season. They were 3-0 down to Everton at halftime.
Yeah.
The weekend just passed. But then they also went to the Etihad in November and won 4-0. So yeah, it makes really hard reading for either team. Spurs, I think they've won 3 of their last 15 games in all competitions. And since the beginning of November, They've 11 points in 13 games. Only Leicester and Southampton have worse. So it may sound like we're catastrophizing two big teams having a bad run of form, but it's kind of hard to not when they're sitting genuinely like so far down the Premier League. And I was looking at Optus supercomputer, and because I do love the supercomputer. But,
yeah, you love the supercomputer.
But basically, if you don't know what the Optus computer does, is it simulates 1,000 seasons from where we are now and works out how many times basically teams finish where. United, from this point on, United's chances of finishing 16th or below is 10%. So 1 in 10 times United will finish 16th or below. And only 0.1% of that is in a relegation zone. But still, finishing 16th or below 10% of the time from here on in for a team as big as United is absolutely staggering. And their chances of finishing 7th or above, so European football spots, 0.4% from where we are now. So it might sound like we're catastrophizing and saying it's a crisis, but a team as big as United, bearing in mind United are currently above Spurs as well, a team as big as United sitting in 13th at the minute are having given a 0.4% chance of European football via the Premier League finish result. So not including, obviously they could win the FA Cup. Oh no, yeah, they could win the FA Cup and they could obviously win the Europa League. But finishing in the top seven and earning some form of European football through that 0.4% chance versus a 10% chance of finishing 16th or below. Like, this is quote unquote a crisis.
I mean, okay.
Okay, I know where you're going with that. And I actually, I do get all of that. I just mean that situationally.
Yes, optics-wise, yeah, it's as bad as it could be.
This is like uncharted territory for United in the Premier League era.
Yes, that's true.
In that sense, it is a crisis, but I know where you're going to get onto.
Because what I'm going to say is like, when you are in crisis, the expectation is you need to do something to get out of the crisis. And with United have already done the thing that you do to get out of a crisis, which is you sack your manager and bring in a new guy.
Yeah.
Now, what they haven't done is anything else. Like the transfer window, they've done nothing. They're going to ship out Antony. They're trying to ship out Rashford. Looks like they might sell Garnacho. Seems like they're trying to raise funds so they can get Patrick Dorgu over the line, who they really like. Though they had a 27... Okay. They had a 27 mil bid for him rejected. I really like Dorgu, what I've seen of him. You know, he's a 20-year-old left-back, plays for Lecce. But you're already paying 1.5 times what it would cost you to get Alvaro Carreras Fernandez back from Benfica, assuming he wants to come. Mm-hmm. Maybe they've asked and he doesn't want to come, and maybe that's why we're not talking about it. Because, you know, he's playing in the Champions League right now. I don't really know why they're not just doing that. But anyway, they've obviously got in Amorim.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't been amazing. Okay.
Sure.
Like what do you think of the early returns here? Because I have my own opinion, but I kind of want to hear what you have to say first, because you're like... So okay. I'm just going to run through some of like the basics here.
Okay.
So he's the first United manager to lose 5 or more of his opening 10 games since 1932. Like Walter Krickmer in 1932.
Big up Walter.
This is Pete's research, by the way. This is Pete's like three Guinnesses deep research.
Sure.
On the bottom half of the Premier League on Christmas Day for the first time in history. Very funny. Happy Christmas to me. they've already conceded 3 goals or more 5 times this season, which I would say is bad. That seems bad to me. And they're also obviously not really scoring freely either. So Amorim, I think, is actually kind of handling it reasonably well. Like, I've broadly been quite impressed by Amorim's like willingness to just front up to the press and be like, look, you know, this is my job, this is my responsibility. Like, even when someone was like, oh, were you knocking Rashford when you said this? He was like, no, it's not about the players, it's about me, like, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's my fault, I take responsibility. And I was like, this is all good stuff. The only thing I've really seen him say that I thought was, like, truly dumb, as far as I recall, was after the Arsenal game, he was kind of talking up the performance.
Mm.
And I thought, well, I hope that that's what you're saying publicly, but it's not how you feel privately.
Sure.
Because defensively, that was a really bad performance. And sure, I saw a load of like comps of like Harry Maguire afterwards, but I was like, you got a red card and gave up like a fucking lot of XG in this game. Like, I mean, like, by all means, praise the spirit and everything and praise the fact that you're able to get it done. But I would hope that behind closed doors, he was like, we've got a lot to work on here, guys. But you know, this is, again, like, managers are entitled to say whatever they need to in public, so long as you hope that they're like being a bit more critical in private.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been quite impressed by him in that regard. And clearly he's just like, he doesn't seem fearful or whatever. He's just like, this is how it is, you know? So what do you think? Like, when you've been watching United recently, are you just kind of like, I expected it to be like this? I mean, it's maybe a bit worse than I expected, or it's about as bad as I expected, or whatever. But, like, I can take the pain. I don't know.
Yeah, so I agree with him in the media. I think he's actually handled it really well, because it's very, very easy to really lay into a guy who's delusionally defending his team. Yeah. I think he's been able to take the sting out of it. Also, like when he said United, well, maybe this is the worst United team in history. But like he said it in kind of like a half-joking, half-serious way, that gave the headlines that the papers wanted, but was almost so ridiculous a comment to make that nobody really took it with a huge amount of value or weight.
Yeah.
But it also kind of just moved on the story. And it was like, the way he's handled the media has been really good, and has kind of shone a light on where we are, or where United are in this transformational period. Because I don't know what people, specifically United fans, expected to happen immediately when Amorim came in, because he was coming in the middle of a season, inheriting a team that wasn't built for his system, and inheriting a team that has historically had very, very bad purchases, very costly purchases, and not a lot of return on investment on a lot of those purchases. And I've ended up that United squad is like this big, just a very strange and expensive collection of players. If you look at the amount of money spent in the last 10 years on transfer fees, United have the most expensive squad in the world.
That is absolutely bananas.
And the only team that have spent more money on them gross on transfer fees are Chelsea in the past 10 years. So this United squad that we're seeing now, regardless of who's a manager, regardless of what system you're trying to play, you look at that squad and that is the culmination of the most amount of money spent net in world football in over a decade. So that in itself shines a huge light on one of the biggest issues, if not probably the biggest issue that United face, is that they've got this really expensive squad that doesn't work for Amorim's system, but arguably doesn't work for any system. Like I would say to anybody, take these collection of players, take this squad, and show me a system where everybody has a natural position and is a natural fit. I think any, you know, normal feasible formation or tactical play will always have one or two players at least trying to fit into a position that they're not completely natural in. Bearing in mind the amount of money United have spent, I think it's 1.3 billion euros net in 10 years, this is a real, real problem. So I don't know how quickly people really expected Amorim to turn United into a good team in his own image, because this is not only systematic and seismic changes within the setup and the system, but it's also trying to shift a lot of people who have been bought for a lot of money and on a lot of wages and not doing anything, which is famously difficult to do, while also finding financially viable, not huge risk players that fit the system, could develop or will develop into elite level talent. Like, there are three stages there at least that are very difficult to navigate and will not be navigated over a single season, let alone the handful of months he's been in the position at the minute. So I don't think, I'm not overly shocked by this. And I think it was really weird. So probably in a weird way, his first game, like the first plays of his first game in charge, were the worst thing that could happen. It was the game against Ipswich. Ahmad was playing right wing back and everybody was talking about that. Rashford was started at nine. Everybody was talking about that. And Ahmad assisted Rashford within the first 120 seconds of that game. Mm-hmm. And everybody was like, holy fuck, here we go.
Yeah,
Amorim's at the wheel. And then, you know, United went on to draw that game 1-0.
1-0.
Oh, we'll draw that game 1-0.
It is hard to draw a game 1-0.
Sure. But that was obviously the start of this very, very up and down season. And I'm not shocked that the performances are poor, because basically Amorim's trying to implement a new system on the fly in the middle of a season, many weeks of which he'll be playing twice a week. He's already commented about how little time he's had on the training pitch. I think he's had like four or five sessions in the past 2 weeks, which has been his largest run of training sessions, like his largest block of training sessions where he's actually been able to get the players on the pitch, on the training pitch. So the scenario is that you've got a squad that isn't built for the system. They're trying to learn the system on the fly. They're also not overly good, because there's a lot of players that want to be either that need to be moved on or are looking for a new destination. And he's trying to get that through while playing twice a week. So I'm not overly shocked by the results. And I think that this is the start of quite a long rebuild. Because if you look at the overlords at United, the decision makers who have put Amorim in in charge. I think you can criticize them maybe for their choice, but the fact that they made this choice means that they have to commit to this kind of new era of it, because there's no point in implementing or appointing Amorim mid-season to then sack him mid-next season, unless like it's a catastrophic failure. I think this has to be, everybody has to start singing from the same hymn sheet, and this will take time. So I feel that the club's invested in it just from the appointment alone. And also I haven't heard a huge amount of like murmurings or rumours about whatever going on behind the scenes. And it just feels like this is the first stage of Amorim's system getting better week in, week out, or progressing with a team that understands it more, and significantly just adding players who fit the system and players that Amorim wants there, want to be there, and shifting a lot of the dead weight. And I think once you do that, which this isn't short term, this is like multiple transfer windows. This is January, summer, next January, next summer probably as well, before you start seeing like a legitimate cohesive squad that is built in like Amorim's image. So
yeah.
I feel that the expectations on Amorim's success and the speed at which he would find success was substantially misguided by large portions of football fans, United fans, and just general fans. But what are your thoughts on this from the outside of Amorim?
I agree with basically everything you said. I think you had to expect some pain coming in. Like, the squad is badly constructed, even if you were playing a formation that did fit everybody. If you were playing like 4-2-3-1, which is probably the closest you could get to a formation that would fit everybody, it still wouldn't really fit everybody, especially at left back. You'd have a bit of an issue, though. I guess you could play Martinez there. But like, they hired a coach who just doesn't make sense for this group of players at all. And it was always going to be rough. That said, I'm not really seeing anything positive. That is a bit of a worry, in that obviously the results have been poor. You know, like 11 points from 11 in the league, 15 scored, 20 against. The XG numbers are slightly better than that, but they're still like -2 XG difference, which is bad. What helps a little bit is that they have had some like pretty decent results, they had a decent performance against City in the end. They had a good performance against Liverpool. I was quite impressed by that.
Yeah.
I didn't think they were very good against Arsenal, but like, it's certainly a good result. And you know, down to 10 men, like, what are you going to do? So I think those help a little bit. And I do think it also helps that they were so bad from the start. Because what you were saying about that goal within 120 seconds, like, I know what you mean, but overall, I think they're really fortunate that it was so bad at the beginning. Because I kind of thought, if they have like a new manager bump and they have like 15, 20 games where
the Solskjaer effect. Yeah.
Where their stats are shit, but they're like getting results, exactly what happened with Solskjaer. Then when he has this cold run, which he will because the squad's really bad, then he might get fired. Whereas I think if you have a cold run at first, like, the team's not, they're not going to fire you after like 20 games. Because if you fire a manager after like 20 games, they basically need to have lost every single game. It makes it look like you, the people who hired him, fucked up, rather than that the manager fucked up. Whereas if you sack the manager after 50 games, then you can say, well, the manager just wasn't good enough. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, in that sense, it's good. But I really have been quite shocked at how bad they've been. I sort of thought we would see more in like build up, you know, like more kind of established patterns of play, I guess. Whereas John Muller on Twitter has kind of made the point that like, maybe part of this is what happens when you hire a manager from a league where the majority of teams are just like fucking terrible and are willing to let you have the ball wherever you want. So he was pointing out that in a lot of United games, he was like, Onana passes the ball to one of his defenders. That guy gets pressed. He passes it back to Onana. Onana passes it to the other side, and that guy gets pressed. And it was like, and the reaction is like, oh fuck, they're allowed to press us here. And there is a little bit of that feeling sometimes when you watch United. You see Onana get the ball, and it's that same thing again of just like, oh god, I literally have no earthly idea like what to do with it. I don't trust either of the guys I've got to pass it to, and they're both under pressure. So, like, what the fuck are we going to do about it? Like, that's happened quite a bit. There's an interesting point in PPDA, I think. I was looking at the PPDA since he took over, and United have been the third most aggressive in the league after Bournemouth and Liverpool since he took over. So they're trying to press.
Yeah.
That potentially is, like, I think that is going to make things look bad. Like you have basically two options when you're a coach who comes into a club and you want to teach them to press your way. You either try and get the defense and everything working first with no press so that you're not overexposed, or you just start teaching them to press and you accept that you're going to give up loads of terrible goals, you know, when teams just play through you.
Yeah.
So someone like Arteta did it the other way, where he played really boring possession football and he only brought the press in once he got the centre backs he liked. I'm trying to think of somebody else who's done it the other way, where they were like, let's just press. I guess like Lopetegui kind of did it with West Ham. He was like, let's just press. And like, they literally had no fucking idea what they were doing. They're also more dominant in territory. I was looking at opposition deep completions. So these are passes within 20 meters of your goal that are completed by the opposition. And Arsenal are top in this. Since actually, the margin is kind of funny because Arsenal and Liverpool are top in this. But United are third. And in the 11 games...
That's really interesting.
In the 11 games, United have allowed 49. Liverpool have allowed 47 deep completions. And Arsenal are top and they've allowed 16. Like that's the gap between the Arsenal defensive output and everybody else, which is pretty fucking funny. But I was like obviously at the moment it's not really showing in their defense. Like they are the opponents may be getting relatively few touches in the high areas for United, but those are turning into big chances.
A lot of set piece goals as well.
Yeah, those are turning into big chances like quite often. Like at the weekend, I was like, I'm going to watch a bit of Brighton United because I know Brighton are going to win.
Sure.
Like literally, I was like, I know Brighton will win this. Like Brighton are good. Brighton are horrible to play against for everyone. United just don't have it right now. They're going to lose to them. And they just lost them. I was like, I was completely relaxed. Like when United equalised, I was like, was completely relaxed. And actually in that game, you can make the positive case that like the high press led to their penalty, which led to their goal. So there are a couple of things in the tactics that like seem to be in the embryonic stages, you know? However, it is quite hard to find positives. And I'm not saying they should like sack Amorim or Amorim's crap, but like it is quite hard to find the positives. Like when I watch them, I'm like, the build-up play, there are no real patterns of build-up play that I think are good. Like, and sometimes I'm kind of like, we got a question a while ago, I think, that was like, was Glasner's Palace team ever good, or were they just good when Olise was fit? And with this United team, I'm a little bit like, is the good stuff about this United team Amad Diallo? is that kind of it?
That has been one shining light, but I think I agree that there has been very, very little to kind of cling on to. And I think defensively we've been bad, but with the aggressive press not being efficient or being like elite or kind of being fully formed, and also in the games where Amorim wanted to play Casemiro and Eriksen in a central two, which have zero legs and means that teams can just play straight through the middle of the park.
Yeah, that wasn't good.
He did it multiple times. The chances that we give up and the goals that we're conceding are not forgivable, but they're understandable. I think what's more depressing is what I expected to be him to implement earlier or quicker was like more fluid, creative attacking play. And United haven't really done any of that. And you can see, like, it scored 26 goals in 22 games. I think only six teams have a worse record than that. They're, like, mid-table for expected goals and assists, 12th for passes in the penalty area, 16th for crosses. But they have the sixth highest possession. The only teams above them with more possession are the other big six teams. And basically what that tells me is that there's just a team that has a decent amount of possession that doesn't know what to do with it. And that can be seen in the fact that United have the second most backward passes in the league behind City, but obviously City are City and they complete over 120 passes more than United per game, so I'm not shocked that City topped that. But the fact is, like, it feels like United get territory, get possession, get up the pitch, and then have no idea what to do with it or where to go with it. And there's been very, very few things to cling on both ways, but particularly going forward. And you know, it again, it's not shocking given the composition of the squad. Like, we don't have a starting quality number nine. Rasmus Højlund scored 2 goals in 1,000 minutes. Xerxes got 3 in 800, I think, but he's also kind of floated between lines. Outside of that, who are you going to play at nine? You've got loads of different types of wingers, none of whom really naturally properly fit the style that Amorim wants to play. You rely on Bruno for all of your creation. If Bruno doesn't create, other than Ahmad this season, there isn't much coming from elsewhere. You've got defensive midfielders who can either pass or defend, but not both, which limits you to what you can do when you're playing a double pivot. You need to really, you know, you're between a rock and a hard place because you're like, well, this guy can defend, but we need somebody who can pass. But the guy who can pass can't run. So it's like, what the fuck do we do? You've got wing-back rules now that you don't have a natural wing-back in. Ahmad's been great, but he is still more of a winger than a defender. Diogo Dalot's been like shoehorned over on the left. Ironically, young Luke Shaw would kind of be really interesting in that left wing-back role.
Sure.
But now, if he's fit, he's going to be a left centre-back. Like, I don't really see him being of any significant use in that left wing-back role in his 30s. You don't have a first... Oh, well, you do have a first-choice right-back, but you're having to play him at left-back. You're having to use Mazraoui in every position available because you need to plug a hole. So all of this stuff is just so chaotic that even if Amorim is able to, which we haven't seen at a top level, but say he is able to implement these cohesive, exciting, clinical attacking teams and passages of play, I still think it's super difficult to do that, or almost impossible to do that, with the squad he has and the kind of players that
he
has available to him. That said, Amad Diallo is the one shining light of this season so far, and I think we can actually kind of both take victory laps on this, because at the start of this season, or in the off-season, whenever it was, Amad Diallo was my breakout player for this
really?
Season. Really? Yeah, yeah. And I think you were skeptical mm-hmm. about it. You didn't hate it, but you weren't like sold fully on it. I think he's been fantastic this season. But also, you can take a victory lap. When Amorim was linked, you were the first of us two to think, okay, maybe Amad Diallo is an interesting fit for that right wing back role.
Sure.
Based on the players United have available and what type of player he is. But yeah, he's been fantastic so far this season. He has 6 goals, 6 assists, top both charts of United's goals and assists. And obviously he's, you know, subsequently the most goal involvement. 0.75 goal involvements per 90, which is like by far and away the highest in the United squad. And also interesting, like over double his nearest competitor, like positional competitor in Garnacho. Bruno is closer. Bruno's at like 0.57, but that's on the assumption that Bruno was competing with nobody for position a minute.
With nobody.
So it's Amadeo's closest rival for minutes anywhere on the pitch will be Alejandro Garnacho, who is under half of his expected goal involvement output per 90. And he's been on fire recently. You know, obviously a lot of this will be impacted by the hat-trick he scored against Southampton. But since the start of November, only Salah and Isak have more direct goal involvement than Amad Diallo. Amad Diallo's got 5 and 5 since November. And only Bruno has a higher expected assist for United this season. Granted, way, way above. But considering there's nothing going for United, and considering Bruno has been doing all of the creation numbers on his own for years, the fact that we've got somebody who's been able to finish goals, who's been able to take games by the scruff of the neck. Like, United were terrible, terrible against Southampton. And Diallo just went and won it. Like, he just went, like, last 10 minutes, scored a hat-trick. He just went and won that game for United. United didn't deserve anything from that game against the fucking whipping boys of the league, too. And he's also been good in creation. So I think what's interesting with players that we might look to sign, and there's parallels, you've already mentioned one, but... What's interesting is the fact that he's able to play as that right wing role, or the kind of right inside forward, but he's also able to play that right wing back role. So Amorim's tended to use him as a right wing back in games where we're expecting to be more dominant, so we can, you know, load up that side with more attacking entities. And teams where we're expected to be the lesser team, or to have to like sit in a lower block team, like games against Liverpool or, you know, bigger teams than us, teams than us. All of the 12 teams above us, and probably a couple of teams around us.
Yeah.
Ahmad has either started on the bench or started in that block of middle attackers, and and Amorim started a more conventional, traditional defense, like defender in that right hand wing or that right wing back role, which makes a lot of sense. Also makes kind of a lot of sense for Dorgu, if that is a thing. But that versatility, I think, has been huge to be able to use Ahmad in multiple ways in different situations and still kind of get a lot of those numbers. Like his hat trick came from right wing back, but he's not really a defensive entity in that game. But I think his performances have been fantastic. I am happy that my breakout star has come to light. But outside of Ahmad, I really struggle to see anything significantly positive in this early Amorim stage. I think yeah. we're really, really in the trenches here at the minute, because this, like, fundamentally, where Amorim is now is the kind of most vulnerable position that he could be in. So basically, he's come in mid-season. He hasn't had a window yet. Obviously, we're in the, well, we're in the middle of a window now, but he hasn't had a summer window. He hasn't had a pre-season. And he's now, him and the club are now at a decision where it's like, what do we do? Like, do we panic and go get somebody that might not be perfect, but it's better? Or do we wait and just, like, ride out a horrible season and just take the flak for it? And Amorim's at his most vulnerable stage at the minute, in my opinion, because he's not actually had any chance to do what he wants to do or what he needs yeah. to do. And yeah, yeah. fundamentally, this is what we're seeing. And I don't think it's Amorim making Ahmad good. I think Amorim's system helps Ahmad a lot. But I think it's just that we have one shining light at the minute who's just a player who's also super hungry. Like, he wants to prove himself. And you can see, like, in his pressing, the amount of goals he scored or the amount of chances he's created of forcing turnovers.
Yeah.
Has been really, really positive. That's another positive, like a real visceral positive you can see on the pitch from him. And then also, like, he'll do that and then he'll sprint the whole way back and block a cross coming in from wide. Like, he has put the work in. But outside of that, yeah, it's difficult to be overly positive about anything you've seen on pitch.
Yeah, I think that's basically true. I mean, I don't know. Like, we'll reserve judgment for the rest of the season. I guess, like, what I would really like to see is some evidence that, like, there's a little bit more of a plan, you know, that, like, there's a plan for progression up the field. There's a plan for what we do when teams, like, press us aggressively, that there's a plan for, like, all this kind of stuff. I think he's capable of it. Before we move on to Spurs, because, like, we are overdue moving on to Spurs, if United could do one thing to improve themselves, what do you think that one thing would be? Because, like, they've obviously been...
Do you think they can improve themselves with one thing, though?
No, but I think that, like, you know, there'll be one thing more than others will likely make the difference. So, for example, when you're like, they don't have a starting quality centre forward... Like, I kind of agree, but I'm also like, guys, you've got £100 million worth of strikers, whether you like them or not.
They'll be
so you need to fucking use those guys. Like, to me, it's kind of obvious. Like, when they're trying to get Patrick Dorgu, I'm kind of like, yeah, I actually do think that that is what they should be doing.
Yeah, I think the targeting players like Dorgu. So I'm going to roll multiple answers into one kind of large point. If they might be cheating, okay. But sure,
it's true.
Basically, targeting players like Dorgu that are good systematic fits and upgrades on positions where United have basically nobody in at the minute. You know, Diego Dalo spent a lot of time at that left wing back role, despite being our kind of starting right back last season. Targeting the huge gaps, filling them with somebody that fits, makes sense, and is a good age and profiles well for what Amorim wants them to do. And also shifting on and replacing the deadwood, like the players like Casemiro and Eriksen have no real role or place in the squad, trying to shift them on for somebody else, free up wages there, move on players who don't want to be there or don't fit. You know, I would prefer to keep Garnacho, but if you get very good money for him, maybe, you know, it means that you can go and get a more natural fit in that kind of inside forward role, because you'll have more manoeuvrability in the transfer market. Also, you've got to think about next season. United will have less manoeuvrability in the transfer market if they don't get European football, which is very, very unlikely at this stage. The best they can hope for is winning the Europa League to get them in the Champions League. And, you know, while that's a total possibility, it's definitely not a given. And United need to prepare for a world where they don't have European or continental competition money, which will restrict them further in the transfer market. So things need to be moved out. Players like Anthony need to be moved on. I'm not sure what stage his loan deal is at the minute, but, like, that's a player you want out the door with no return. And, yeah, a really significant but intelligent squad reshuffle. Cut the deadwood that doesn't fit. Add a few players that don't need to be... Like, none of these signings, like... It wasn't even that long ago United were signing, like, 30-plus-year-old Zlatan Ibrahimovic or Edinson Cavani or, like, Alexis Sanchez at 29 for Casemiro. Huge money. Casemiro is the most recent one, yeah. But Dorgu is a much more progressive approach to squad rebuilding, or rebuilding this United squad. I think that plus a pretty cutthroat and efficient, or as efficient as you can be, given the fact that they're sitting on big contracts, potentially some of them for long periods of time, as efficient as you can be culling of players that you don't want and replacing them with smart, young players that you feel can add something to your squad sometime between season one and season five.
Yeah, great. Well, on that note, let's move on to Tottenham Hotspur, who, despite starting the season kind of like a rocket, have actually sunk into a crisis at least as deep as United's. So as we speak, Ange Postecoglou is like odds on to be the next coach sacked in the Premier League. Is that right?
Yeah. So if you bet 10 points, or the last time I checked on Sky Bet, if you bet 10 points, you would get 15 points back. That includes your 10 point stake.
Jesus. And so the thing is, like, the attack has been flying a little bit less lately, but the attack this season has generally been good. The defence has been the problem. And this was, you know, true last season as well. So I think in that way, like, the current situation where they've had a bunch of, like, really bad defeats, including this last weekend, losing to Everton, which looked... if you just looked at the scoreline, you don't see how bad it was.
Oh,
like, going 3-0 down in the first half to Everton is, like, astonishing stuff. Everton, not exactly, like, free scoring, but... Jesus.
I reckon we could put a pub team together and not be 3-0 down at Goodison at halftime.
If we just kept it tight.
Yeah, we'd kept it tight, low block. No funny business.
Funnel the ball to Calvert-Lewin.
Yeah.
Like, he'll sky it, doesn't matter.
The goal he scored was good, though.
Yeah, no, the goal he scored was incredible. But, like, anyway, they've just been shipping goals to, like, literally everybody. They're not entirely like United in the, if they went up against, like, Brighton or something, I'd kind of be like, they might just show up. They might just show up. But I think if there weren't these worries about, like, Ange's defence, people would be a lot less concerned now. Because to me, it's not just an injuries thing, but it's overwhelmingly an injuries thing. Like, there are also other factors here. So, like, you've got in this research, 11 of Spurs' 12 losses have been by a single goal. And, like, generally speaking, like, close games, I mean, you don't know how close those games are. I haven't, like, looked at the XG in all of them.
So of those 11 single goal losses, 9 of them are within 1 XG.
Okay. And generally speaking, when teams have a bunch of those games, like, a bunch of them end up in draws, some of them end up in wins, some of them end up in losses. When you see a team that is always converting those games into wins, that's normally not super sustainable. You know, those close games will come back to bite you. You just can't run hot like that forever. And when they're all turning into losses, then that will improve. You know, like, they won't be losses forever. So from this point of view, there are lots of reasons to think that they're due a little bit of a bounce. I just think that, like, should we just get to the point with this? Like, would you sack Ange? Because I just wouldn't. I think it's a load of money that you're going to have to spend to sack him. And if you sacked him right now, whoever came in would be like, well, I've got to pay Archie Gray and Dragosin at centre back. Like, what am I going to do?
Like, I don't think they should sack him. I think he's completely fine. I think there are, like United this season, super highs met with super low lows. Yeah, okay, they've only won 7 games in the Premier League this season, but if you look at the aggregate score of those games, it's 23-3. And if you think you play those games where you absolutely slap teams and you get a little bit more fortunate than you have been in those very, very close games, you're kind of sitting mid-table, and mid-table for a team that's having to play a full second-string defence and keeper every week at the minute isn't super shocking, especially in a system that relies on, like, it's very risky system. It's high risk, high reward, and it puts the defence under, or can put the defence under, a huge amount of pressure based on the way that Ange wants to play. So the fact you're having to play players like Ben Davies, Dragosin's getting, like, tons of minutes and is just not at the standard that a top six team would want their centre back to be at. Archie Gray's a child. You know, they're playing a keeper they signed, like, 2 weeks ago, just straight in.
They signed him, and I think he was in the team the next day. within 24 hours, basically.
Yeah, so if you look at any of the big teams, any good team, any team in the Premier League, and you take out 4 of their starting back five, including their goalkeeper, and replace them with their backups, they're going to have a real struggle to maintain any significant form to, like, put them up towards the top end of the table. Because there are a lot of very, very dangerous teams out there now, like Brentford and all. There are a lot of huge, they're way more dangerous teams than there have been, than there were, say, 10 years ago. So the teams that are smarter, more well-drilled, with more interesting managers and systems that can punish you. So this is just a situational thing. I think it'll get better. And yeah, like, who are you going to replace him with that's going to make an instantly significant uptick difference? Nobody, because it's predominantly situational. I think what's interesting as well is that the Premier League season's burned for them. Similarly for United, burned. Realistically, they're not going to get relegated. Like, come on.
Yeah.
But Spurs are in all of the competitions that they entered still. They're in the semi-finals of the League Cup. They're 1-0 up against Liverpool, but have to go to Anfield. And the winners of that will probably play Newcastle, given the score and the fact that I don't think Arsenal really give a fuck about the League Cup.
Not now.
They're in the FA Cup, which is early stages, see what happens. And then they're in the Europa League. And on paper, like, if you look at those Europa League teams, who on paper is better than Spurs? You've got Athletic Club, Porto, Galatasaray maybe, Lazio. Like, Frankfurt are decent, but they're about to lose Mamrush. Roma have only won 2-6. United are there, but they're in the mud as well. There are a couple of very, very good opportunities here for Spurs to go deep in a competition and win some silverware for the first time since they won the League Cup in 2008. Ange, in my opinion, is keeping him gives you the best option to do that. If you're able to add a few more players as well, just to make the squad a little bit more robust. We said, I think, at the start of the season, going into the season, Spurs were a bit thin and then have been decimated by injuries.
Yeah.
And subsequently now look like incredibly thin. If you're able to make that squad a little bit more robust in some of the high-profile areas, that will help you a lot. Then you'll get players back from injury, and you have the opportunity to get some silverware. And if Ange manages to get silverware, it doesn't matter what it is. Literally could be a League Cup. I feel that will exonerate so much of the shit that has happened this season. Like, so many people will forget, or at least Spurs fans, will forget about how shit they were in the middle of the season or when everybody was injured, or they'll forget about all the criticism and they'll be like, you know what? You've brought us our first trophy in 17 years.
Yeah.
And we're actually in a pretty good position squad-wise if we add a few more components and we think that you're actually a good manager. So I think sacking him would just be... I was so shocked when I looked to and saw that it was like 1-2 odds. It was so short for him to be sacked next. And I guess the rope that he has isn't infinite, but I would really, really be hesitant to sack him before the end of the season.
But it's like a narrative thing, right? As in, like, everyone's decided Ange is near the sack. And so every time he loses now, people are like, surely he's gone. Like, after the NLD, people are like, surely he's gone. Like, after the Everton game, surely he's gone now. And you're just like, but if the reason is always the same, then there's no reason to get rid of him. Now, don't get me wrong. I do think there are
criticisms, yeah.
There are criticisms. Like, the fact they try and play the same way all the time, I do think is, like, kind of dumb.
It's naive.
Yeah, and it's just like nobody plays like that. Like, it's kind of that thing. Do you remember when Arteta was getting criticism for playing more defensively earlier in the season with Odegaard out?
Yeah.
And he said, I'd like to go out. He was like, it's raining outside and it's really cold right now, and I'd like to go out in shorts and a t-shirt.
Sure.
But you have to pay attention to the context. If I did that, you'd think I was an idiot. And he said, well, there's no point me doing it and then saying, actually, I'm very brave. You know, because he was like, that's kind of what you're saying to me. You should be brave and just play the same way. And he was like, nobody does that. Well, Spurs kind of do that a bit. Not entirely. So, like, the idea that Ange never changes anything, I think is, like, total bullshit. Like, you only need to look at the Liverpool game to see that. The Liverpool game, they played really intelligently. They were clearly the better side. Liverpool basically couldn't do anything on the day. Like, Salah was totally locked up. And maybe he just had an off day, but, like, they were pretty impressive, I thought. They can do it, and they played their wing-backs more reserved. Like, when they first got all these injuries, they played more reserved football. And then it was like they kind of gave up on it and decided to go back to their Ange ball. And there's the other part of it as well with Ange ball, where I'm kind of like, given how good you are at coaching attacking patterns, you know, when I see a guy with the ball on the edge of the box, I see people run past him in ways that are clearly, like, orchestrated and smart. Like, they clearly, like, have a plan for, like, what they're meant to do in that situation. And yet, like, when they're in defence, they don't seem to have any clue where they're meant to be. Like, that is so weird to me. I was just like, how can you be so good at telling people, yeah, this is where you need to be in this situation, but you literally can't just, like, organise a fucking defence?
But it is also Ben Davies being asked to play a super high line and he can't fucking move.
Yeah, but that's kind of what I mean. Like, part of it is like...
Oh, as in, like, and isn't adapting to that.
And also, like, okay, they've got a lot worse with the injuries. But, like, if our point is, like, Ange also is a bit of a problem, then you know, we should probably point out that the defense wasn't great even without the injuries.
Yeah.
Like, the defense has never been amazing. And the way they play through, they try and play through presses, you know, like, in the NLD, like, Arsenal just kind of squeezed them into the position they wanted them to be in to press them. And Spurs just couldn't deal with it. Like, they were, like, stuck there. And maybe with a more experienced, better passing goalkeeper, they'd be okay. But once again, I was just like, surely you should be able to drill the team to take up positions or to deal with this in such a way that they're not constantly playing into the teeth of the press.
So obviously, Ange wants to play, like, the whole Ange ball wants to play through ball on the ground, short passes, progress ball up a pitch, three presses. Arsenal are a very, very good pressing team. And they knew that Spurs were going to do that. They knew that Ange was going to do that. So they set up and benefited from it. Like, Solanke got received seven passes in 90 minutes in that game and he had the lowest touches of anybody who completed 90 minutes.
Sure, and, but I mean, like, he's a striker. He doesn't get that many touches anyway.
I know, but the thing is, they committed to playing to a way through a press that was better than their ability was to play through it. And that, in my opinion, was very, 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 very naive, because also they don't really play long balls, certainly not from the back. I think they're lowest in Europe for over 40-yard goal kicks this season. But if you look at a player like Dominic Solanke, yeah, sure, he can play in a system where you want to progress the ball through a press on the ground, short passes, as Ange wants to do. But at Bournemouth, he can also run through and cause defenders a huge amount of problems with balls over the top, which Spurs just didn't do. Like, Spurs didn't react, Spurs didn't change to try and be like, okay, we're playing in the teeth of a press here and it's not working. What skill set do the other players have around me that we can utilise? If you look at him last season, no team had a higher proportion of line-breaking passes over opposition defences than Bournemouth did last season with Solanke up top. Like, I'm just asking for something different.
Sure.
When
something
doesn't work. So it's like, okay, I get the nobility of sticking to your guns and being like, this is how I want to play football. But doing that to the point of where it's just for the sake of it is naive, and he needs to be more intelligent. And I think that's the reason why it's the highs are so high and the lows are so low. No team in the Premier League in the last two seasons has fewer draws than Spurs do. So it's a case of where this is what we're going to do. If it works, fantastic. We fucking slap this team. We win 4-1. But if it doesn't work, we're going to lose this game. And there's very, very little in between. And I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it's like, people always say, at least historically, you know, like, Premier League winning teams are to finish high up the Premier League. You need to be a team that can win ugly. You need to be a team that can, you know, win a game that you weren't meant to win. You just grind out a result on a shit day. This approach does not help Spurs become a team like that. Their bad days will result in losses, and they have historically resulted in losses under Ange. Their good days are great, but he needs to work out a way where he can adapt enough to turn those bad days and bad losses into something, into a draw, into an unearned 3 points, you know, something, because Spurs are dropping too many points willingly just by being stubborn.
Yeah, I agree. And like, I just think that, like, they do need to add a couple of like little parts in there. Like, as much as I do agree that they need to have like more game control, they need to find ways to slow the game down when necessary, I do think that that's about adding some pieces. But like, we could go into it forever, but fundamentally they need another couple of centre backs. They could do with a utility forward, and they definitely need a game controlling defensive midfielder who is decent under pressure, who mops up the ball a lot, and who kind of keeps it simple. Like, at the base of midfield, they just need somebody who can do that, because right now you're in the situation where you're like, oh, can Bentancur or Bissouma come on and control the game? And just even Bergvall, who I think we both like. When Bergvall gets on the ball, that's the thing, he's exciting. He gets on the ball, he turns and runs, he tries to burst through the centre of midfield, and I'm like, yeah, this is what everyone does at Spurs. You need a guy who looks up at the scoreboard, says, oh, we're winning 2-0. I don't need to play this game at 100 miles an hour. We can pass it around at the back for a while and just not get blown up. So, I don't know. I guess that's our take on Spurs. Basically expect them to be fine. I think it would be kind of... The only reason I'd sack Ange is if you really do feel like that he loses the dressing room, so to speak. But, like, I don't know. Look, if Iraola's available in the summer and he wants it, then you can consider giving it to him. But otherwise, keep the faith for now. Shall we move on to the burn book? All right, burn book time. And let's start this week with what we're putting in the burn book.
Okay.
What have you got, Pete?
So what I'm putting in the burn rug this week, absolute slam dunk. Everybody in the world will be in agreement with me, apart from a very small faction. BMW drivers.
Ooh, okay.
So sure. As a collective, they are one of the worst groups to exist in society. I genuinely think that there should be a specific register for them, and you should have to notify everybody you live within a 500-meter radius when you moved in the area. Be like, by the way, sorry guys, just let you know, I actually drive a BMW.
And somebody covers their child's ears.
Just takes their child away. Yeah. And I actually don't think this is controversial. This is a super, super common opinion. And okay, there is some resistance when you make a blanket claim like this. But the arguments against it are very much of the same kind of ilk of the not all men response to the Me Too movement. It's like, yeah, of course we're not referring to all men, but you're focusing on the wrong point here. Similarly, BMW drivers being cunts. Yeah, okay, sure, not all BMW drivers are cunts, but you're focusing on the wrong point here.
It's a useful rule of thumb to say that they are.
But so this was born out of basically Jess recently started driving again. So she
bought a BMW.
Cunt. We're getting divorced. So she did the London thing where she passed her test when she was 17, went away to uni, then eventually came back and got a job in the city. And, you know, she didn't drive at uni. She worked centrally in London, didn't need a car. And then it got to 10 years later and she hadn't driven since the first year that she passed. But now we're obviously having a kid. We have a car and I do all the driving. She was like, I need to get back into driving. So that was fine. She did some refresher lessons and she's great. She's great now. But I've been driving regularly for 14 years. And what I've noticed is that when Jess drives, she won't notice things that I notice just because you know the hazard perception test of the theory test? The way where you're driving along and you see things that you're meant to click out that that's a potential hazard. It's that, but more and more nuanced. Things you only know through experience of driving and driving for long periods of time. So you're the behavior of the cars around you will tell you what they're likely to do next. And you only really learn that through having lived it many, many times. Say a car beside you speeds up right behind the car in front of them, they're probably going to want to pull out in front of you. They're looking to get out on a motorway. They're probably going to pull out right and go fast. Simple things like that. But when it's a BMW, I pay attention to basically no other car than the BMW. And this could be confirmation bias, but I just know that BMW is about to do something dickish. And almost always they do. So it's the kind of person who, when you're say you're on a motorway and you're at a junction where there's cars merging onto the motorway from a off-road, you'll see a BMW with its indicator out, and you just know for a fact that as soon as they get across that bend, they're going to shoot from the very, very far left-hand entrance lane the whole way across to the other side of the motorway and speed off into oblivion. You just know that's going to happen. And I would say 8 times out of 10, it happens. And it's just other things when you're at a junction and it's a BMW is just pulled out in front of you. Not even joining your lane of traffic, pulled out and stopped in your lane and essentially playing chicken with the people on the other side of the road to give them the space to move out. And you're just you're just a dickhead. And yeah, so I've been subconsciously aware of this for obviously years, but I've been much, much more conscious of it now because I'm thinking about it more when I'm in the passenger seat. Because it's to be helpful. You don't want to backseat drive, but it's I'm just keeping an eye. You would see things develop that are potential issues. And it just kind of refreshed my hatred for BMWs and BMW drivers. Now, obviously not all BMW drivers are dickheads. Richie, you remember Richie from my wedding? He used to have a BMW. He's mostly not a dickhead. He's got a Porsche now, so still a bit of a dickhead. But
big dickhead.
And there's a guy I play hockey with, lovely guy, got a BMW. What's the worst thing about him? But other than that, lovely guy. So obviously it's not all BMW drivers, but it's just the ratio of dickhead owner to normal owner in BMWs, in my opinion and through my own research, which I can publish on the Patreon if you want.
I would love
It's staggeringly weighted to dickhead, far more so than any other car brand.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's totally fair.
And I forgot how much I hated them until I was consciously looking for things more than just subconsciously reacting and driving on the road. And it's been an interesting few months just looking out for BMWs. If anybody pisses me off on the road, I would say 70% of the time it's BMW driver.
That's extremely high.
London. really high for London as well. Like people, the standard driving London is quite poor. Well, I mean, it's poor, but it's also quite cutthroat. Like you kind of need to be a little bit more aggressive because it's so busy. But 7 times out of 10, I'm just like, dickhead. They're the kind of guys who like overtake people on like residential road where the speed limit's 30. And you're like, what are you achieving? You then pull up behind them at the next set of traffic lights. You're like, well done. Well, what did that achieve? Nothing.
Yeah, they're in a rush to get to, I don't know,
7 yards in front of you.
To get to the gym so that they can do like 3 sets of bicep curls. Yeah. It's 3 sets of 10 bicep curls, weight that they can't really lift. Cheat the curls, then go home.
No. Then go to the tanning salon and then go home.
Yeah.
Dickhead.
Just like to tell you like how it's like that. You know that video where it's just like, I could beat up Anthony Joshua. I don't think he's a very good boxer. Like, it's that kind of guy. You know, they'd be like, the thing about Anthony Joshua is he just doesn't move his feet fast enough or whatever. And I'm like, mate, I've never watched a boxing fight in my life because I'm not a fucking weird cunt. Like,
sure.
I just don't need to like earn my dad's respect through the medium of blood sport. Like, it's just like, fine. To fucking grow up. But it's like that genre of guy. Yeah, no, I completely get this one. Like, I also just think that like when somebody has like a really, when somebody has a really expensive car as well, just generally, I think, twat. Like, it's quite rare that somebody, it's quite rare that somebody, but you're just like, it's such a fucking stupid, everybody knows that it's kind of a waste of money. Like, as soon as you buy an expensive car, like, it loses half its value, right? Like, the second you drive it out of the dealership.
Yeah, basically.
And so you're like, why are you buying this? Like, well, maybe, you know, there is a reason for you to have, like, a Range Rover or something. Probably not. It's probably just that you're a cock. But, like, generally speaking, with this kind of stuff, I'm like, there's not a good reason. You're just a twat. It's just a status symbol. You just think you're hot shit.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same as any luxury item, really. It's you're buying it because you like it. You also could be very into cars. I'm sure I'm fine with that. I'm fine with luxury cars. I'm fine with all of that. Just don't drive them like a dick.
I think that's fair. I guess that is the takeaway. All right. What have I got? What am I putting in the burn book? Oh, I'm just... Can we just stop being fans of people? Like, everybody online is just like... A bit, yeah. Like, it's okay to like someone's work. Okay, but like whenever I'm online, I just feel like I'm constantly like running into people who are like, oh my god, like worshipping somebody.
Oh, like stan culture.
Yeah, and I see this even with like normal people in my life. And sometimes it's like a musician, it's like you literally can't say shit about like Taylor Swift or whatever, or people will go fucking berserk. Like, truly, you know, with some people, it's like the royal family. Like, you can't say shit about
is.
Without them losing their minds. You know, like, I just find it all just, like, a bit demoralizing. The idea of, like, tying any part of your identity to how much you like this one person,
yeah,
I think is, like, so obviously insane, especially given that, like, now that we know, as I talked about in, like, our predictions for 2025, now that we know so many of these people are pieces of shit behind the scenes,
yeah,
I don't understand why you'd still be, like, running a fucking Ariana Grande fan account. I don't understand why you'd be,
to
like,
be fair,
posting
she's,
about
she's
how,
gone
like,
off a cliff.
Sure. But I don't know why you'd be posting about, like, why you think X person is, like, oh my god, he's such an amazing, like, good guy. Like, I see this all the time. Like, honestly, there's somebody I know who was posting a lot about Keir Starmer like this, like, around the election. And a lot of us who know this person were like, what the fuck is going on here? Like, it was truly like, I'm reading his like autobiography. I think it's amazing. Like, just seems like a really great guy. And I was just like, are you fucking serious? You're the only person in the world who's this big a fan of Keir Starmer. Like, get a fucking grip.
Yeah.
And I just find it childish. I find it childish. Like, the whole thing. But if I just opened my like, my fucking like Instagram now, you go onto your Discover page and it's literally like, oh my God, like Blake Lively, like, is she the most beautiful woman in the world? Like, I don't give a fuck whether she is or not. Like, I don't care. Like, oh my God, like, look how funny this interview is with fucking, I literally don't know who the fuck that is. Like, just all these people, I'm seeing clips of people on late night shows where everyone's like saying they're so fucking funny. Like, everybody's like fucking dancing and showing off. Just shut up. I'm finding it hard to summarize what I really hate about it, but I just think that it's like, I constantly see hero worship online. And then I constantly see people being like so disappointed to discover that the person I hero worshipped was not in fact a hero, but a fucking human being with flaws. It's just boring and juvenile.
I think when you go to that degree of fandom, you lose all sense of objectivity because there's like nothing can be bad. Nothing, you can't register anything bad about them. So the fact that means that it kind of devalues anything you say positive about them because you're actually not considering everything or things that would like are legitimate points being like, well, you know what? They are a good musician, but are they the best musician ever? Like, let's be real. No.
And it's okay to be like, I just fucking like them. But it also provokes you. It turns you into like a weird kind of person. So I think about these fans, you know, like Chapel Rowan saying like, my fans like, leave me the fuck alone. People throwing shit on stage. Like you see these clips of like people throwing shit on stage at Billie Eilish. And she's just like, you stop fucking throwing underwear at me or whatever. And then there are the fans who are like, we're the real fans. Like when she told us to stop throwing underwear, we stopped. And it's just like, no, all of you are fucking weird, like little subhumans with like parasocial relationships with people online. I think this often when I see somebody's, even when I see somebody's selfie with someone famous they ran into, they're like, oh, I ran into insert famous person here on the street and I asked him for a selfie. Don't. That's weird.
It is a bit weird.
If they offer, if I ran into like Nicolas Cage on the street and he was like, and I was like, I really love your work, you know, just really big fan of yours. And he said, do you want a picture with me? Then I'd say, yeah, sure. But what I wouldn't say is, can I have a picture with you? Because that's a fucking weird thing to say to a stranger. And the answer should be, no, that's weird. Like, I just don't really like it. I just think it's like infantile. Leave people alone. Don't be a weird fan of people. If you run a fan account of someone, I'm sorry, but you're a fucking freak. You don't have a special connection to them. You're just a fan of them. And can we just separate work from the person? Like, Ariana... Okay, the other thing is there are occasionally people who pop up who I'm just, like, particularly activated by. So there's a woman called Tate McRae.
Oh, yeah. I have no idea what she does.
She's a singer.
Okay.
I think. Like, she definitely sings. Maybe she does other shit. Yeah. I don't care.
She looks like a Disney cast off.
She looks like any woman on earth. Pick any woman on earth, that's what she looks like. But whenever I see clips of her, it's like she's gonna take over in 2025. Oh my god, how good is this song? And she sings in that really indistinct, like Ariana Grande way, where you're like, what words are you saying? I can't really tell. Like, you're not really using your teeth or tongue.
Yeah.
You're just using your throat to make these sounds.
Oh, kind of like Britney Spears in the late 90s.
Yeah, but Ariana Grande's terrible for it as well. Like, so every time I'm like, no idea what you're saying. All these people are just like, isn't she the most incredible dancer? It's like, she's dancing, like she can dance, I guess.
She is like, an incredible like vocalist, if her annotation isn't great, sure.
Yeah, but that's kind of, who are we talking about now? Ariana
Grande.
Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah, I'm not talking about Ariana Grande anymore, though. But yeah, but Ariana Grande, a bit. I do think that this is all a relic of like Mariah Carey. Like, yeah, I like Mariah Carey fine, but I do think people came to the conclusion that like being a good singer is about doing being a bunch big of like melisma and trills and like showing off a little bit, and it's fucking not, and that's stupid. But yeah, every time I see a clip of this woman, everyone's just like, oh my god, isn't she so incredible? Like, she's gonna finally get the stardom she deserves. And I was like, you know who she is. Is that not the stardom she deserves? I don't know who the fuck she is. Probably because she's not that fucking good. Maybe she's got the stardom she deserves. Maybe she's got more stardom than she deserves. That's probably true.
Mm.
It just gets on my tits. And
I can see you getting visibly more annoyed as well.
I just find it embarrassing. I just find the kind of... And also, I think chat show stuff, I just see people... Sometimes someone will be telling such a fucking boring story.
Like the late night chat show, yes.
Yeah. And the late night guys are just like cackling away and acting like it's the funniest fucking thing they've ever heard. And I just think, you know what? If this show didn't exist, you wouldn't have to be pretending like this.
Mm.
We could just bin this show.
Yeah.
Like, let's just not do this anymore. I think all those chat shows are fucking moronic.
I've never understood how there's so many of them and what the appeal is. Like, I've watched clips of some of them and I'm like, this is fucking dead.
But it's like people going to like going to a coronation in medieval times or something.
Mm.
They're like, oh, we're all covered in like shit and vomit. Like, let's go and see the king. Like, we all smell like pigs, but I've heard he has a bath, you know, like stuff like that. That's kind of what it is. So you have all these like pathetic fucking people in the studio, like watching, I don't fucking know, Cynthia Erivo tell a story about like, oh, how powerful it was to work on Wicked. Mm. Fuck off. No, it wasn't. Like, all you did was film a musical no one gives a fuck about. Shut up. It just pisses me off. Anyway, I'm going to move on because I'm just working myself up, but I don't really have anything coherent to say except that I think people who hero worship people are babies. What are you taking out of the bourbon? Actually, I'm going to do mine first. Mine's okay. Really quick. Do you know raspberry licorice?
No. All I'm thinking of right now is licorice pizza.
Okay. Also, great. So raspberry licorice doesn't taste anything like licorice. It's actually delicious, unlike licorice, which is disgusting. But it's just like a sweet, chewy treat. It's not insanely like high in calories. So you can have a little bit of it. You know, like I care about that. Other people not. I've just got into it recently. They sell it at like a little deli place near me and I buy a bag of it and like Emma and I eat it. And it's just like, because it's really chewy, it takes you ages to eat one of these little sticks of it. And I find it very satisfying. It's fucking hard on my teeth though. My teeth hurt. So.
Okay. So yeah, it kind of looks like the type of, or at least some of them look like the type of sweet you would get in like a Haribo selection, but it's obviously
which is extremely my shit, though I'd say it's harder than that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I enjoy a jelly sweet, like I really enjoy jelly snakes, you know this.
I mean, I specifically bought yellow bellies for you to sample at my wedding.
I appreciate that, and boy did I sample them. And I think I took a couple back to my Airbnb. Yeah, I just like this. It's a nice little snack. It's a fun snack. It puts you off by associating itself with a disgusting substance that is not delicious.
Yeah.
Namely licorice, but it itself is good.
So I'm also getting served things for Red Vines, the American candy.
Yeah, so Red Vines, I think, are technically strawberry licorice.
Yeah.
So I also like Red Vines, but I guess in my mind,
I've had Red Vines.
I've had Red Vines, but here I don't think that we call it strawberry or raspberry licorice. I don't know what we'd call those. We just call them fucking sweets. So I do think it's kind of an American term.
Mm.
But yeah, I like it. It turns out I like it. What are you taking out of the burn book?
What I'm taking out of the burn book is being the devil on someone's shoulder.
What the fuck? Okay.
Now, you might know what this is in reference to.
We actually do this to each other, I've got to say.
This is the thing. But this isn't... It is something I love doing. Being
Emma
a devil
did this to you as well.
This is... This entry wasn't prompted by me. It was prompted by Emma.
Okay.
So when I say being a devil on someone's shoulder, I don't mean like poorly advising someone to do like something hugely damaging to their life. I mean being like a little Tom Haverford. Treat yourself on somebody's shoulder. Like the person that hypes you up enough to make like a purchase that you haven't had the balls to make yet. That type of devil on your shoulder. And your wife was the driving force behind a rather expensive purchase I made this week.
Yeah.
So I mentioned about it before, about the camera that I've been eyeing for a while. Fujifilm X106, for anybody who cares. But they're always out of stock. They're really, really hard to get, particularly in the silver colorway, because it's like the vintagey colorway. It looks like this camera's from the 70s are really cool. And they're also like super expensive, but they come into stock and like go immediately. And I whenever I spoke about that, whenever whatever episode that was, a couple of months ago, Emma like messaged me after she listened to it. And she was like, no, you need to buy the camera. she was like, oh, they're great. You won't regret it. She even used my unborn child as justification, saying wow. That it's great for preserving the memories. Like top quality devilry on show.
That is devilry.
But that sat in the back of my mind for a while, and I was kind of checking the website kind of daily, multiple times a day, to see if it, because they randomly just come back into stock, and when they come back into stock, they're like gone within minutes. And I found one in silver, put it in my basket, and I was like, oh, I don't know if I need to spend this amount of money on the camera right now. And I like debated it for a couple of minutes, and within that couple of minutes, all of them sold out. And for Jesus. me, that was kind of like, I don't think many come back in stock. I think we're talking like, literally these are coming off production lines, being put on the website and going. But for me, like missing, like I was genuinely disappointed that I didn't get it then. And for me, that was kind of like the coin flip test of if you have like two options, you're torn between flipping a coin is meant to reveal which one you actually would prefer.
Sure, because your reaction
how,
to the
based
one
Based on how
get.
Happy or sad you are about what the result is. So the fact was like, I had it there, I was going to buy it and I didn't buy it. And then I was like, if I wasn't fully invested in buying it, I'd have been like, okay, you know what, fair enough. whatever. But I was like, no, that's, I'm gonna, I thought about that for like days, being like, fuck's sake. So at that point, I decided, right, I'm just going to buy one. And I, you know, it's taken a couple of 2 or 3 weeks for them to come back into stock, but they came back into stock yesterday. And I was just like, fuck it, straight in the basket, purchased, no thought. Arrives, it's meant to arrive tomorrow, but I had to delay that because I have to go to the office tomorrow. It arrives on Friday. And I do not think I would have purchased it if it wasn't for Emma's devilry on my shoulder, because
yes.
I feel I would have been a lot more like standoffish about it all. I would have not gotten that one initially and I'd been like, ah, whatever will be, you know, whatever. Or like, I wouldn't have been checking frequently enough to know that they're, because they've come back in stock, because you only get a vanishingly small window every time they come back in stock. So I wouldn't have been on the ball enough. And every time, say I checked monthly, every time I would check, you know, it would be staggeringly lucky if they would just happen to be in stock. Mm. But more than likely, they would all be out of stock all the time. And slowly it would just kind of fade away into a memory of something that I thought about buying once. Whereas this kind of really injected like an impetus of like, no, I want to get this camera. And then I kind of went on a mission to actually get the camera, all or significantly in part to the catalyst, like Emma providing like the, she lit the wick of my desire to buy this camera, and it arrives on Friday.
Yes. No, I do like this. I think it's nice when someone basically gives you permission to just do the thing that you want to do anyway. You know, it's like being influenced into something, I think, is like when you wouldn't have bought it anyway. Whereas the nice distinction between that and this, you know, being the devil on someone's shoulder, is that like
you want
it's something that you want, and they're saying to you, you know, you can just like just buy that. Like just it's a good idea. Like, and I think you're not being a knob.
It's like the closest you can get to gift giving without actually having to give a gift or spend any money.
Mm-hmm.
She's giving me the gift of like justification. It's okay, just yeah. Do it. And yeah, like she's giving me a gift that I have to pay for, and I'm completely fine with that.
Agreed. Yeah. I'm also fine with that because we need to save money.
And also, she's to blame if Jess ever comes asking, by the way. Just
that's fine. For Emma won't care. Emma will be like, Emma doesn't give a shit about any of that. Like, the good thing about it is that sometimes I'll be, every now and then I'll be like buying stuff and she'll be like, really? You bought another thing? But most of the time, if I'm ever umming and ahhing about something, at most she'll say, do you have the money to buy this? And I'll say, yeah. And she'll be like, just buy it.
Yeah.
Like, Emma's constant refrain is, just get it. And I'm like, okay.
I love that. Oh, yeah. So let me get like, on so sure. Well.
Would yeah, you, sure, I will just get it.
Just a couple little Tom Haverfords. Treat yourself.
Yeah, exactly. All right, that brings us to an end for the public episode. We will catch a bunch of you over on the paid side, where we'll be talking, I don't know, we'll be talking a bit of West Ham, we'll be talking a little bit about like history with like football commentary, I guess, and some fashion chat as well, because, you know, we have to do that. Thank you very much for listening. We really do appreciate it, and we will see you soon. Bye-bye.